There's something about the tension between vision and humility. If you've got an idea and a vision for something, you have to believe in it and go for it. And that requires lack of humility. It requires what could appear as arrogance or overconfidence.
I'd love to hear a bit about Next 25, because this as an initiative in itself is quite impressive. What was the problem you were trying to solve? How did it all kick off?
It came from working on complex issues, whether it was land use planning and forestry in Tasmania, water across Australia, the tsunami response, and then climate change and the role of forestry and agriculture in climate change. But I had a real sense that while society was understanding that there are some big challenges that we're already facing as society or that are coming our way, and society isn't yet capable of really tackling those issues. This sort of think and do tank idea emerged because so many things fail because just do the thinking and you think you're the smartest person in the room. So the do tank element was, and we're going to marry that with innovation and entrepreneurial practice to actually build solutions.
All right, here we go. Ralph Ashton, how are you?
I'm well today, thank you.
Today?
Yeah.
Always?
No, not always, but today's good.
Good to hear. You're a bit late. You got caught out on the bus.
Yeah, the bus. But the apps, they're good now, aren't they? They show you exactly where the bus is, how long it's going to be. Yeah. So that's all cool.
So you're pretty precise. You told me when you were getting here.
Yeah, that's right.
we won't go down that rabbit hole. Ralph is a superstar, so I'm really looking forward to having this conversation, mate. I think it'll be fun.
Good.
And you know, for a lot of our audience, I think there's a few components of our discussion that I hope we can dig into that might be of interest. I certainly find you an interesting character and the things you've done very interesting. But, you know, the development of Next 25 as you know, I guess an entrepreneurial play and your leadership and learnings from that, which are amazing. I guess the fact that at work you did there has a tremendous reference to Australia and our landscape and some big moves that were being explored. And I think there's some really cool discussion we can have around that. And I think part of this could be looking at you and where you are now. You've exited, you've moved on from Next 25. You're in this place of renewal, I suppose. And I think it's a real privilege and opportunity to go through that at different stages of life. And I know some of our listeners, some of you personally have been through this, and there are real opportunities to grow and reflect and change and all of the above. So, mate, we'll go somewhere with that. But maybe to provide everyone a little bit of context, Ralph, bit of the story. So to just to lay the platform, who's Ralph?
Oh, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because that question often gets the default is to go to, here's my CV, I did this, then this, then this, then this.
Yes.
Which I probably will run through in answer to your question.
Which, to be fair, those little markers help build the story, right?
Yeah.
But it's a bigger discussion today, right?
Yeah. So I think, who am I? So I was born and grew up in Papua New Guinea, obviously to the north of Australia for those people who are thinking it's somewhere in Africa, which happened to me the other day. So I was born there, grew up there, and There are literally hundreds of languages in Papua New Guinea, and they're not dialects, they're languages. So the reason I bring that up is because even though I was young when I was in Papua New Guinea, so from 0 to 14, I still feel like that element of diversity and so many different ways of looking at the world, given so many languages and different cultures, has really impacted how I think about things. And I also grew up in so my dad was a bishop and my mother is an educator. And I grew up in a not crazy religious setting, but I still grew up with a lot of religion around me. And it's kind of this juxtaposition of like 600 or 700 different languages and a religion teaching, you know, there's one way. So that was a
Bit of a dichotomy there.
Yeah, bit of a dichotomy, right? So I've grappled with that a lot through my life, and I've come to an understanding about it, which I'm satisfied with. But I say all this because that definitely coloured, both those elements have definitely coloured sort of a key part of service. So use my gifts for good. And I'm really, really, really skeptical of people who say they've got one answer or the answer or the silver bullet or the magic. I'm like, really? So Papua New Guinea, then I guess what I love and always have loved is beauty in all its forms, and that goes from everything from, you know, beautiful landscape to an amazing PowerPoint deck, you know, like the whole gamut. I love that.
PowerPoint decks can be pretty, can they? They can be beautiful.
I think they can be beautiful, and I think that there's a even in a solution to something, an elegant solution is beautiful to me. So beauty, as I say, in all its forms, really is one of the things I love. Bringing people together, I really, really, really enjoy bringing people together, and not so much having, like, not even really having a reason, just being a catalyst of people coming together and then creating possibility. So I don't know. Should I go into the CV now?
Well, I mean, for me, hearing that and knowing your story, I can see that being the melting pot for Next 25. But you know, maybe you can talk about the pre-Next 25, because I think some of that might give some context to how you think about problem solving. One of the things I really like about Ralph, and for anyone that's listening to this, the complexity of some of the problems and the scenarios that you were involved in and the learnings through that are so useful for all walks of life. And even just some of the points you made there about not having a singular answer or, you know, having a combination of considerations of the value of, you know, a key identity and inclusion of many identities, you know, complex ideas. Yeah. So, So I won't steal all those ideas, but I do think, maybe a little bit of the context, because you started life in, you know, very traditional type of jobs, like in law and investment banking, and then things evolved from there. So I'd love to hear a bit about that too.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I guess relatively typical of high achiever at high school, then went into a course at uni that I could get into. So law and arts. I remember my dad saying, oh, that's a good first degree, law. Go and do another one after that, which I never did. But then I was a corporate lawyer in doing mergers and acquisitions. I loved that. I loved the cut and thrust. I loved all the detail. Same with, I moved then from law to banking to see why bankers get paid so much more than lawyers. And I kind of still don't really know, but I loved banking as well. I love the deals. I love the fact that in banking you do all the kind of legal stuff, but you also do the maths. You do those presentations to get people on board with an idea of a deal, right? And you can make 1 and 1 equal 3. And so I really loved, in both law and banking, that, again, that creating a possibility and also working out, okay, so you're worried about this risk. This person really understands that risk. They can price it a lot better than you can. So let's shift the risk from you to them so that it's priced cheapest, right? Basically, I think of in a transaction. So law, then banking, and those jobs, as most people know, are pretty all-consuming. And I've got a creative side around, I love photography. So I went off and was a professional photographer for a couple of years. And in that work, I worked with World Wildlife Fund to create a book on the second largest unprotected temperate rainforest in the world at that time, which happened to have been in Tasmania. And got a bunch of photographers and poets and writers together to go and document this amazing part of Australia and created a book. And from that, that led into working with World Wildlife Fund in Australia on policy and advocacy. So all these like legal and banking skills and mindset were totally applicable to that public policy area. And then I think there are two or three more steps before Next 25, which I've just handed over the reins for. After that work on forests in Australia, I worked with colleagues around the world to set up a coordinated approach to the tsunami for World Wildlife Fund. World Wildlife Fund is basically a franchise organization you could think of. So all the different national organizations weren't necessarily working together. So we created an umbrella to coordinate all of that and work with then the United Nations organizations, the Indonesian government, Sri Lankan government, Indian government, Thai government, all the donor governments, the World Vision, Red Cross, all the people who are working on the response. We were like, well, you've got to think about the medium and long term as well as the immediate. And for the environmentalists, you've got to think about the immediate as well as the medium and long term. And then the final step before Next 25 was then setting up with colleagues an international group on climate change, agriculture and forestry, looking at the 30% of climate change emissions that come from land use, which also happen to be the 30% that are in the cheapest abatement opportunities. So that was a big sort of trying to reframe a problem with the best minds in the world to then have an advocacy approach and make some things happen. Long answer, sorry.
No, it's a good answer because there's plenty in that. And to me, there's this theme I'm already seeing, right? And for anyone listening, the theme of collaboration, the problem solving, the complexity, even the way you just described the way the World Wildlife Fund tsunami issue was, you know, contained in your mind as a stage gates of looking at, you know, the immediate impact and the long term and future and the different stakeholders and their needs in that. I mean, that's a lot about, you know, you and how you think that I've noticed. So we probably can get into that. But one of the things I want to ask before we go into Next 25 and some of your philosophy around business is to just ask a curious question. A lot of people be going, well, you just ran through your career very quickly, Ralph, and there seems to have been this acceleration of access to large profile pieces of work or interesting pieces of work with a lot of different stakeholders. Early on, what was your approach to pulling people together and getting in touch with these sorts of people and generating these opportunities? How did that all start?
Some of it was just one thing leads to another, right? And so there wasn't necessarily a big plan, and certainly not a plan for each of the transitions through my career to date. And in the early stages, it was a combination of me seeing a problem and then either working with colleagues or coming up with a potential solution to that problem. And then, yeah, I guess it's a snowball thing of then working out who a key person is in that problem area or solution area, or the people who are doing the solution over here that's not working. So someone in there who I have enough access to that I can go and talk to about, oh, I've got this idea to do this, and start testing the idea or even testing the understanding of the problem and the potential solution, right? And then from there, it's like, oh, no, that's not a good idea. Okay, reframe it, come back. Maybe it's, oh, okay, that is a good idea. I'd like to explore that. And then they open the doors to other people to talk with, and then there's a chain reaction and a snowball. But I think that's only possible, or was only possible in my case, because I was genuinely curious about these things. And so I'd be going to people with curious questions. What do you think about this? What's going on? Not sort of a blame game or I've got the answers or that sort of thing. So I think that curiosity and it being genuine was a key enabler. And then I think I'm pretty good at building trust, like with people pretty quickly, and I'm competent, so I do what I say. And there's a whole backstory to that building trust, right, which is I was sent to boarding school really young. I had to work out how to have a group, because my family was hours away by plane, and I was like, right, how am I going to have a group? oh, the way I'm going to have a group is I'm going to have to be trustworthy and have and build connections.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's how you survive.
That's how you survive. I obviously didn't have that rational process then.
Yeah.
But that's, I've come to see over the years that that's like a superpower that came out of some adversity as a younger person. But that, yeah, it's been really helpful in later life.
It is certainly. It is certainly. It's amazing how many of our guests have shared that development through something that's happened quite, you know, challenging or quite negative to build and become something that's actually a huge strategic power or superpower, as you describe it. So let's just move into we can talk a bit more about yourself, but I'd love to hear a bit about Next 25 because this as an initiative in itself is quite impressive. There's a great deal of cool things that you're involved in. So I'd love to just hear how that played out. There's a lot of people that might be aware of it, but there's many of our audience I suspect haven't engaged with you. So yeah, what was it about? What was the problem you were trying to solve? How did it all kick off?
Yeah, so Next 25 was an idea about 12 years ago. It came from working on those complex issues I talked about earlier, whether it was land use planning and forestry in Tasmania, water across Australia, the tsunami response, and then climate change and the role of forestry and agriculture in climate change. And I got this real strong sense that there were, and I was working overseas a lot of that time, right? So I had this sort of international perspective looking at things, seeing how other countries were dealing with things, coming back to Australia often. But I had a real sense that while society was understanding, or at least parts of society, especially experts, but also I think at an intuitive level, the community more generally, was understanding that there are some big challenges that we're already facing as society or that are coming our way, whether it's artificial intelligence or low productivity growth in Australia, for instance, or the rise of Asia from a geopolitical point of view, or climate change, all sorts of different things. And society isn't yet capable of really tackling those issues. So we keep bumping up against sort of on all of these different issues. Homelessness would be another, and chronic illness would be another. We keep bumping up against almost like a brick wall. So my hypothesis was there's something going on deeper down in society that is making it hard to get breakthrough progress on a whole range of issues. So if you think about a big ship, the big ship is steered by a tiny rudder compared to the ship, and the tiny rudder is a long way away from the lever that is turning the rudder, and the rudder is invisible to most people because it's submerged beneath the ship, beneath the water. So I had a hypothesis, and this builds on systems theory and other people's work, but that we could find these little rudders in Australian society, and if we could just shift them a little bit, we'd unlock action on lots of things. So I started Next 25 12 years ago with a team to explore, well, you know, A, is there really anything wrong in Australia right now? Because at the time, everyone that I was hearing and reading about in the news was like, Australia's really dropping the ball on a lot of things. It's very disappointing. We're kind of stagnating, blah, blah, blah. So I wanted to know, is there really a problem, or is everyone just whinging? And then if there's a problem, what are the common causes, or are there common causes? What are they? And three, what can we do about them? So this sort of think and do tank idea emerged of do all the analysis and get the systemic view of what's happening in the Australian system to find these rudders that we could just shift a little bit, but not just do that because so many things fail because you just do the thinking and you think you're the smartest person in the room, but you haven't got a solution, you haven't got a way to bring it to life. So the do tank element was, And we're going to marry that with innovation and entrepreneurial practice to actually build solutions.
It's a great concept. It's a great theory. That's challenging in practice, right? So I'd love to rip that apart and hear it, because, you know, I think that analogy with the ship is really, really useful. You know, the idea of systems thinking, and you can see, and people hearing this can really instantly go, oh yeah, I can see how that plays out. You move a great ship, and you, in your own life, you can see situations where, when the root cause is really addressed, you know, a lot changes, in either, whether it's at a personal level or a team level or a company level. In this case, you're saying at a national level. When you did that research, when you tried to define, what did it reveal about Australia and our relationship with, you know, how well we're going, whether there is a problem, what were the problems?
Yeah, so I ended up speaking to over 1,000 leaders back then over a year or two, asking them those curious questions. And the answer that came back was definitely there's a problem. There are 5 or 6 key things in the way. And really surprisingly to me, very, very, very few, like 0.4% or something of those leaders across all sectors had a specific idea of what to do about those deep levers. So they're kind of like, yeah, it's really, there's a real big problem here across a lot of issues. And here's the diagnosis of why, the common causes, but don't really have an answer. And I coined this term, the powerless powerful, because these people, whether they're known leaders who get in the media all the time or just community leaders who are doing really effective work without too much hoo-ha, they're powerful people, and yet they feel like they don't have power. So we, at Next25, we updated that research more recently, just before I handed over the reins. And I could go into the, if you want, the 5 things that the 5 common causes that Next25 found. The first is that we don't, in Australia, we don't have kind of a shared vision for where we're heading. And I think it's fair to say that that wasn't that we need one vision that everyone subscribes to, but we don't even have kind of generally we want to head here, and we don't want to head here. So if you don't have that vision, it's very hard to know where to go or even what to argue about.
Absolutely.
And that another thing that we found was that we overweight economic measures in definitions of success. So GDP and monetary valuations of progress are just so dominant. And you know that by just consuming media and even how government reports.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to let you list them out, but there's a big part of me wants to jump into these because they're so interesting. And I will interrupt, because I think the first piece before we go in down the chain, yeah, like, it's, you know, the first principle, and anyone who's looking at their own business will say, where am I trying to go? Even with your family and your life, what is important to us? What do we stand for? What don't want you, but we, what we, do we not want to be known for? Even if that's not deliberate, it, you know, at a family or a human level, you tend to at least have this sort of subconsciously constructed view of what that means to you. And if you pull it apart, you'll see it. And then, you know, when I look at the company side of things, you know, this, without that strategy, you get dysfunction. You get people doing whatever they want to do. You get little side projects popping up that no one really understood why it started. And there was one individual's little pet project that actually represented their own personal gain, not the success of the collective. And you see this happen all the time in business community. And what you're saying here is that Australia has the same problem that not all organizations have, but where there's dysfunction, you can see a lack of clarity in where we're trying to go. How can you just unpack that a bit further? Like, when you were talking to these leaders and when you were listening and observing the community, what's our concern with the vision? What's missing in the vision? What do people seem to want in the vision?
I think, I'm going to make a confession first, which is that Next25 is essentially a small business. I mean, it's set up as a charity, and it's non-profit, but it's still a small business, right? And I think we took 10 years to get to clarity on our own vision. So it's like we're kind of reflecting, or we're a fractal of the bigger issue and of what you're talking about with other business leaders. Of if you don't have that vision, it's very hard to get things done. But I think also if you tighten too close in that vision, you restrain and constrain innovation and creativity. So it's kind of like this dance between the vision and the openness. Getting back to your question, I think that people, in a sense, they might not even know what they want. They feel that the country doesn't have an articulated, we want to be fair, we want to be competitive, we want to be this, we want to be that, or even what our goals are for 2030 or 2035. So I think that it's probably more an inchoate sense of this is who we are and where we're heading, and this is who we don't want to be. I think there's also an understanding that a country and a society is quite different from a business, even a business with shareholders and a bunch of stakeholders. It's, you know, a country or a society is just a whole lot of individuals, and democracy and capitalism are the way that we in Australia have worked out how we're going to navigate all of that complexity towards some sort of future and make a whole lot of trade-offs. So it's probably an unsatisfactory answer to your question.
Mm. Is it unsatisfactory because it doesn't have an answer, or is it unsatisfactory because you've only shared the components of the answer?
Maybe a bit of both, you know. Yeah, and I also think sometimes these things are, you can point to something, and the more important thing than getting that thing is the process of how you try and get that thing. And so it might be just enough that Australia puts more effort into a process of trying to better define and argue about a vision. I think this is what you see with frustration with politics, where politics is often focused on the very, very, very short term, that people are, the public and leaders outside politics and even within politics are looking for more than just that short term battle of ideas. They want a longer term battle of ideas, a longer term idea of where we're going.
Does it tie into, and did you notice this through your research and the work you did you notice it ties into human nature a little, in that at times people, because they're feeling pain or because they're in a difficult situation, the short-term needs are far more important at a point in time of their evolution relative to where they actually want to go. You know, you see this, and people listening to this would know this all the time. You and I both know this in our own experience, you know, where there's some sort of acute or conscious pain, frustration, you know, we'll say, well, let's try and fix that thing, but lose sight of the big picture. In other times where you're feeling more comfortable, you feel more reflective, you're able to sit there and look at that big picture, and that maybe that's part of the process you're talking about. Maybe that's part of helping this whole journey unpack. But it's bloody complex. I mean, how did you start to even deal with that when you started to pull different stakeholders together and say, it's not just think, it's do?
Yeah. Well, just in answer to the first part of what you just said, I think a lot of these things, when we feel like we're not in control, or when we feel like things aren't going the way we would want them to go, even not from a selfish point of view, but from what we think is best, I think human nature is that we default to wanting a simple solution, and yet I have a sense that most of the time it's a both and situation rather than an either or. And so you kind of have to hold these two things at once, the short term and the long term, but also have the discernment to know when to flex between the two. And I think that discernment is maybe the most important thing. Like, yeah.
I'd agree with you. I don't think people are taught discernment. We're taught very literally.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like this or that.
Yeah.
Big picture or short term.
Yeah.
So they coexist and one relates to the other and they both live in this ecosystem where we're trying to make decisions where they want both ideally are successful, but they're not always obvious and we can't control the future because of the changing context.
Yeah.
You know, that may be driven by us, maybe driven by events outside of our control.
Yes.
So it's bloody complicated. And realizing that discernment sits in the middle there and that's a responsibility of us as a society to get more comfortable with that and get better at talking about that.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm sure elements of it can be taught, and I have a hunch that elements of it have to be experienced or have to be built up over time through life experience.
Bit of wisdom in that. So we could look at the other five. I mean, you talked about economic and you talked about there's probably other components there. What have you learned even through running your own business around that piece around the economic side? So, you know, there is a tendency in and a lot of our audience would appreciate this, whether it's, you know, their own entrepreneurial journey or leadership journey, but, you know, the number matters. You know, you don't go very far without that fuel. And you're right, in the economic context, we're talking right now, one of the biggest discussions is interest rates and what the RBA is doing and how that impacts everyone and this relationship with the almighty dollar, right? So what did you learn about that more so as a business owner, perhaps, as opposed to at a social level?
Yeah. Well, what I learned in a previous venture is that money's really important because I was so focused on the idea and on the mission and the impact that I kind of, in a sense, lost sight of the dollar and managing the cash flow and the money. And so that became a big problem. So if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs in a business, money and cash flow obviously are critical. So again, I think it's this thing of it's not either or. It's not, okay, we throw away the economic stuff and we just focused on the values-based stuff. But you've got to get all the foundations right to enable whatever the business is doing. So I think of it in terms of, at least from my point of view, there's no point just making money for money's sake, although I guess the impact altruists, who are these ones, the people who are getting a lot of attention at the moment about you just make as much money as you can and then do good with it. So they might have a different point of view. I feel like there's no point making money unless what you're doing to make the money is really serving society somehow. And I don't mean in a non-profit way. I mean like solving a problem, doing something that people actually
adding
need.
Adding some value somehow.
Yeah, and it could be a fun thing. It could be extravagant. It could be anything, but it just add value, right? So make money. But you need to have money to be able to have that impact, yeah? So it's not like it's good enough just to do something good for society. You've got to do it in a way that is building resilience in that organization to be able to keep doing that. And that's a lesson I keep learning and keep learning. And I'm, at Next 25, had and still have a great director of finance. And that's their role, is to really focus on the financial sustainability of the organization.
So did you find that relationship with money changed for you? Did you find that you previously maybe had either disinterest in it, or why do you think the eye was off the ball before? Was it so much consciousness on the purpose, or was there a fear of it or an avoidance of it?
Oh, look, I think then it was two things really. One was just complete amateur of running a business. So I didn't set out to be an entrepreneur. I didn't set out to run a business. I set out to solve a problem and found myself running a charity, which then you work out, well, actually they're businesses, so you got to run them like a business. Yeah. And so it was complete, you know, ignorance at that level, or lack of practice, lack of skill, combined with a 30-something just chasing the ball. I'm going to, you know, going after that purpose. So it's a good lesson.
Yeah, great lesson.
Yeah.
Great lesson. We'll talk about lessons soon, I think. So systems thinking, yes, sits at the center of the way you work, and I can say, yeah, I guess you could overlay design thinking, defining, yeah, the problem, putting those together. I'm really passionate about both, and plays out in the work I do all the time and our team would do, different to your work, but similar principles. Perhaps can you help people understand how that looks, and maybe a practical example of perhaps a project or a scenario, and how I think it can be difficult to help people go on that journey, but what needs to be considered when you take people on a journey where you're trying to solve something quite complex and systematic?
Yeah, well, I might try and do that through two really quick examples. Well, one really quick and one a bit longer. So first is we found another of the five things we found is that at Next25 was that the public doesn't trust government, doesn't trust politicians, doesn't trust the public service. That's not a new finding. A lot of people have found that, but it was one of the things that came out starkly for us. So I love combining that, the probing the system for what's going on with the human-centered design, the design thinking, the lean startup type methodologies to try something quickly, fail fast, build on it, and maybe create a solution. So with that particular challenge, I went and talked to a whole lot of politicians about, well, what's going on? How? And they said, one came back with, well, Ralph, we know how to get elected, but once we get into parliament, it's a really hard job and there's no handbook, there's no course, there's nothing. So wouldn't it be great if there was a professional development program for parliamentarians? So we took that idea through user testing with parliamentarians and the system around parliamentarians. Well, what could that look like? We went and looked at what was being done overseas. What could we copy? We went and found what was being done in the corporate sector for leadership development, professional development. And we created a prototype. And we tested that prototype by actually running it, seeing who came and got lessons, and then built it over time. And it's kind of just now, almost 10 years in, reaching a more steady state form, and it's had now 8 or 9% of all of Australia's parliamentarians through it. So that was, I mean, that was human-centered design, but it was maybe accelerated or not all the steps in it. Another of the common causes that Next25 has found is it's very hard to have a constructive conversation about a contested issue in Australia. Mm-hmm. I think we saw this play out in the Voice referendum and debate. So Next25 now is working with University of Technology Sydney with their transdisciplinary or TD school and a bunch of academics through their CoLab program to say, right, constructive discussion is the problem. Let's now go and understand that. So if we're thinking about the first of the double diamonds in a double diamond process, well, what's really going on? And then where is there somewhere we could actually intervene? Because constructive discussion, massive topic.
Big topic.
Mm. Let's find, and everyone has their views on, oh, it's social media, it's this, it's that. Well, let's actually do some analysis first of, you know, and going broad, what is that? And then come into what could we more tangibly work on? And then Next25 in UTS will then create a prototype of something, or we'll do an innovation ideation process to ideate, well, what could be done about that specific thing, build the prototype, and then learn from that, either throw it away and start again if it doesn't work, or tweak and evolve.
What would be your opinion on that problem? I mean, as you said, everyone's got a view. What would be your view?
One thing that Next25 did find was that particularly in relation to the Voice debate, Next25 did some research on this, was that people fear, at a very personal level, they fear that they're going to lose friendships and relationships, and they fear that they're going to lose something in a professional setting. So even by stepping into a space of ambiguity and exploring, oh, I think this, but I'm not sure, what do you think, that there's a fear. And now I'm not necessarily referring to the Next 25 research, just to be clear, but it might be more my opinion. I feel like there's a fear that I'm going to be painted as A or B, even though I've telegraphed that I'm exploring. So finding a safe space, and this was another thing from the Next 25 research, finding safe places to have a conversation that isn't immediately painted into corners is really hard. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know about this. Maybe social media and other things have been amplifiers of this, but I feel like the solution, and this probably is a general point, that the solution is often not where the causes are. The solution is creating a new thing that takes the causes as part of the new system structure, that's making the system work in a way that's not optimal for how you or enough people want. But it's very hard to blow them out of the system again, because the system's co-evolved to this state. So you've got to build the next thing that enables this to move on.
Well, and it's also a combination of forcing factors, I find, right, that help move people towards a different state, right? Yeah. So if I look at that from a business context, right, if we've got a vision and we're looking at a cultural shift, you know, and people would appreciate this with their own teams if you've been through it or if you've explored this before. It's not just dealing with the fact that people aren't having healthy conversation. You could go and have a feedback workshop. Let's give each other feedback, right? Someone knows that now we need to deploy that. But there's a whole bunch of infrastructure around the business that doesn't make that easy.
Yeah.
The way that we have one-to-one conversations at a performance development meeting, or our one-to-one check-ins with our manager. If that doesn't look different, then the whole thing falls over anyway.
Yeah.
If we don't have a conversation at a leadership level about the importance of feedback, if feedback is a cultural shift we're trying to, well, great. Sounds like a good idea, but you're not role modeling it, so that's going to fall over. If we don't have champions, if we don't have people in our environment that stand out as role modeling and taking those tough first steps and breaking through it and being a bit of a leader of the pack, then again, there's no one to look to as a hero or of the environment that we can say, well, that's what great looks like, right? And I'd imagine when you're tackling these issues at a country level, that those moments of truth and the components of the system, they all work together. It's not a there's not a transactional fix, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think in addition to those things is understanding people's fears, which might be rational or irrational, but I don't think it's much point judging that. It's just if people have fears or concerns, until they're addressed, they're going to be looking for safety most of the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So creating safety so that those people don't have those fears so much.
Yeah. Well, I think all those things I just shared there, they're parts of what creates the safety.
Yes.
Ideally, you know, if the system should be designed to create safety, because without the safety, the system won't work. And this is with any form of change, because the greatest degree of resistance, from my experience, would be the fear of the unknown. I'd rather stand still because it feels safer.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a concept of, you know, if things are too conservative and risk averse, it's fine for a while, but that system is very brittle. So if an external shock comes, it's very hard for it to withstand that shock, and it might
fall over.
Mm. On the other hand, if things are too permissive and too, everything's blue sky and we can do what we like and we love going into the unknown all the time and blah, 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 then there's nothing holding you together. Yes. So you also, it's hard to get things done that have a lasting impact. So you need to find this sort of balance between, or the going backwards and forwards between the sort of safety and the boundaries and the exploration.
Yeah. You made a comment earlier, which was that people seek simplicity.
Mm.
Did you find when you and your team were consulting on these projects that the bias was going to, well, can we just simplify it, or can we find something that's more easier to digest, because what you're describing there is multidimensional, multi-layered. People have different responsibilities in it to hold up one part more than the other. What did you notice about people's yearning for simplicity?
I think a lot of the people I've spoken to are relatively senior or successful in their parts of the system. And again, they might not be household names, or they might be. That's not the point. They've done something which means they've been successful. And those people typically have a pretty broad view on what's going on, because A, that's how they've become successful. They might have done something specific, but within the understanding of a context.
Yeah, and they've matured in that context, yeah.
Or their role at the head of an organization is to have a broad view. So I think some of those people really get the complexity and they're like, yes, and I'm operating in this complex environment. Others feel like they can, if only we could apply what we do in the nonprofit sector to society as a whole and everything was values-based, or a business leader, if only we could just have one metric which was the driver of success and did that nationally and one person in charge and like an autocracy, bang, we'd fix things. So there's kind of this, some people are really in the complexity, understand it, and are trying to do things in quite a humble way to enable an approach through complexity. And others, even though they see the complexity, want the silver bullet.
I can see how that would play out. The silver bullet mindset shows up a lot in all environments, right? In fact, I feel like that's sometimes what we're sold to as a society. If I look at the average, when I scroll through Instagram, and I'll get ads, and everything seems to be fixed straight away if you do this thing. And it seems to be the way we're taught to buy ideas, is that if you do this, then this will happen. Yeah. It's an interesting one. What have you learned about, I guess, the way you take people on a journey with these things as a leader in your own business?
Probably so many things, and so many things I'm still learning. There's something about the tension between vision and humility. And it's kind of like, if you've got an idea and a vision for something, then you have to believe in it and go for it. And that requires, in a way, a lack of humility. It requires what could appear as arrogance or overconfidence. But people want leadership, they want ideas, and not everyone wants to be the entrepreneur or the ideas person. A lot of people want to be on teams that are deploying or trying to deploy an idea, right? So that's a big lesson for me. And at the same time, that I think humility, like a true humility, is a really effective and good leadership quality. So I've got this idea. I might not really know how to get there. It might not be the right idea, but will you come along with me?
Yes, and I've got to put enough certainty in that so you come with me.
Yes.
Or you might come with me.
And also maybe knowing which of all the people that are needed around that process and idea can tolerate or want to be involved in the uncertainty bits, and which of them don't. Yeah. So I went from a fairly closed way of doing things to a radical transparent way of doing things, to feedback along the way, which was, that's too much transparency. Just, rein it in a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably one lesson.
Yeah, that's really powerful. There's many, even including myself, actually, I've been through that journey, where by trying to open people to the awareness of what I'm thinking, it can overwhelm.
And even the fragility of, where the idea is at, that can overwhelm or cause a lot of anxiety, which is not helpful.
Yes, yes. I was taught years ago, one of the things that someone, a bit of a mentor basically, was, and I'd love your thoughts on this, was this idea that, if we're trying to get to the moon, some people don't even know what the moon looks like. But if they can find the next best step and we know that we're going towards the moon, as long as we're confident that that's going to happen and we can get them to the next step, which might be, you know, there's a rocket we're trying to create and we're doing that rocket and it feels really controllable, it feels something really achievable. Let's focus on the rocket. Let's not overwhelm with the moon. I mean, sometimes talking about the moon will engage certain people. Absolutely. For me, it would. It's all I care about. it's the way I function. But how, you know, trying to recognize that there's a group of people that need to hear about both and knowing where they are, it's really powerful.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of some feedback I got, which was sort of came out of the blue, but it was so on the money when I heard it. One of my team said to me, having been with us for, you know, a few months, it's like, Ralph, I really see that you're really good on the big picture and on the micro picture, which for me kind of goes back to that beauty concept of I want everything to be beautiful and excellent at the detail level, but you're not very good at the middle level, which is probably the building the rocket, right? And I was like, wow, yeah, that's really true. And I hadn't thought about it that way. And that was one of the catalysts for me stepping back from being the executive director of Next 25, of the thing I'd created with others. A lot of people have helped along the way, but the founder and executive director, I was kind of like, yeah, the next stage for Next 25 needs a lot of the middle.
Yeah.
Needs a lot of the rocket building. And I'm not that person. And I had this sort of moment of, oh, you know, there's this, I think there's a mentality out there of, oh, you should always be open for the next challenge. And if that's the next challenge, get good at the middle. I was like, oh, okay, I've got to get good at the middle. How am I going to do that? And I don't know. I was just somewhere, I was like, nah, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be good at the middle. Someone else is really good at the middle and other bits, and they can take it to the next stage.
Well, talk about humility. That takes a lot of humility to think through that and to let go.
Or a big whack over the head.
One or two.
Or both.
It'll be a combo, yeah. Well, I'm sure there has to be some humility. What did it feel like going through that process of saying, I'm going to walk away?
It was something that had probably a 3 or 4 year genesis. So there was a moment, I forget how long ago it was now, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, one of my team members was asked onto ABC TV's Q&A program. And for me, that was like, ah, that shows we made it. Like that's it. If you get on that, like tick. And I was kind of livid. I was like, what do you mean, team member? It should be me going on this, right? And I really internally churned on that. And I had enough awareness of having done coaching and professional development that there must be something here that was triggering me, and there was an opportunity to think about it a bit differently. But still, I had this visceral reaction of, this is unfair, this is my moment, it's being taken from me, this is ridiculous. I came to see that through help from a coach, that this is actually awesome, and it showed that the idea I had started with Next 25 was at a stage where it had an organization behind it, not just an individual as the founder, and that provides leverage in the next stage. So that was like a big reframe of, okay, it's not me as the founder of this idea anymore. My job is to do enough to create a vehicle or an organization that can continue for as long as is needed to keep this idea going. So that was a real shift of, it's not about me and getting in the media a lot and getting lots of attention myself. It's about creating an organization. So that was, in a sense, the start of the walking away, in a positive way, right?
Yes.
And then a little bit later, I regularly did 360 degree feedback, as in I got an external organization to run it on me as the leader. And I got this and used a tool that I absolutely love. the leadership circle profile. And the feedback that came back was pretty confronting to me. And I sort of read it. It was one of those cases where I read it once and I was like, oh, this is really bad. I felt sick in my stomach. I read it again. I was like, yeah, it's pretty bad. It's not as bad as I thought when I first read it. And it was all, I couldn't challenge any of it, right? It was like, yep, that all, I can understand that all rings true. And it was another moment of, right, my next challenge is to polish the edges of that and get rid of all the bad stuff and be the leader that people want me to be. And again, I just had no excitement about that. It didn't give me energy. So I got to a point of, well, no, that's actually not my next step. My next step is something else. And I'm not going to put effort into becoming that leader, but that means I have to get out because the organization needs that type of leader. So for me, it was a process. It's been a beautiful process. The board and my senior team at Next 25, we worked through that, I think, really, really well. And I'm very proud of how we did it. And I'm really excited about what Chloe, as the successor, is going to do with it. It's really awesome, even just seeing what's happened over the last 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nice you can say that. You look out and the baby that you created is growing up and evolved. You've evolved with it. Can I ask, and we had a bit of a chat about this offline, but, you know, and it's a question we talk to with it, most of our guests, is these sort of reframing moments. We often ask the question, what have you changed your mind on? Mm-hmm. You know, what's... And not, you know, I changed my mind to catch bus one or bus two. I'm talking about, you know, fundamental shifts in the way you look at the world or who you are in it, and what that's done for you. So I'd wonder, if you could share what have you changed your mind on?
Well, yeah, I've been thinking about this in coming into this discussion with you, actually. And one is definitely that I used to be focused on achievement and success, even unconsciously, but more recently I've been conscious of this as a way to prove my worthiness. And having gone through the process of stepping away from Next 25, and having some space, I really see now that what I do next, I'm still okay with success and achievement, and I hope that's part of my future, but I'm going to be doing that much more from the point of view of just using my gifts rather than to prove that I'm worthy. So that comes with a lot of liberation. Yeah.
Well, you're already worthy, aren't you? That's the story that has to sit underneath it.
Yeah, but, I mean, as we know, that for a lot of us have some sort of deep-seated barrier that's sitting there.
Absolutely.
And for me, I mean, that's been one of them. And you know, rejection has been another. And so another reframe that's come to me over the last few years is, and maybe it's also goes to that leadership question you asked earlier, but I spent a lot of time being nice to people because I didn't want to be rejected. And that has meant that I've hidden a little bit of my light under the bushel, to use that phrase. And I'm looking forward to in the next chapters to instead of, in a sense, building community and safety by being nice, to build community and safety by being more and more and more authentic. Also knowing that that's going to put some people off, but that I'll find my group. And and still do that with other values around it, so it's not aggressive, but to just be, even doing this podcast is a bit like that. And then another one is another reframe, which is funny. People from the outside, whenever I've made transitions, people, even from law to banking or banking to photography or starting different things, are like, oh, Ralph, that's so courageous. I'm like, well, no, it's not really. It's just I'm doing what's coming to me next and I'm just following it. But I sort of feel like I've, in the past, I've played it pretty safe to avoid big failure. And now, sort of connected to that first point about success and achievement, sort of feeling like I don't really need to succeed or achieve anymore. And I've almost got this sense of, instead of go big or go home, it's kind of like go small or go home. It's like sort of weird thing of, and therefore it's okay to fail. Like, who cares? I'm going to follow my instincts and my vision and my ideas a lot more and take more risks. I say that now in this room, mate.
Yeah, well, we're gonna find out, mate. But it's nice to be able to say that. And you know, that middle point, that middle reframe seems to be, that might be an anchor point. They're probably all related, they interrelate with each other. But I wonder, that point you talked about around rejection, you know, anyone listening to this would probably have some experience with that in their life. And maybe that drives achievement, maybe that drives other behaviors. But what was the tolerance with rejection you started to build up already? What have you experienced around rejection in as a business leader, where you go, look, I could handle more of this. I can deal with that. I know that being the nice guy actually possibly sometimes doesn't serve me. Are there examples of that?
Yeah, I'd say two. And in the world I've just been in, philanthropy is, and asking for money is, a huge part of any leader's role. So, and that would translate in other businesses into business development or marketing, right? So selling the product. And I used to find it so, so hard, especially because, again, I think it's the same in any startup. You're asking for money from people close to you is the first port of call.
Mm-hmm.
And that just felt somehow really icky. And actually someone very, very experienced philanthropist said to me, Ralph, you've really got to change your mindset on that. Like, we're looking for things to invest in, to donate to, that are good, and you might have something that's good. If you don't tell us and ask us, we're not going to know. Let us make the decision about what's good, and if we want to back it, don't prejudge us.
You don't get in the way of your own success.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, so I think I've definitely become more okay with the 95% of time being told no. Right. And okay, that's fine. The 5% is all that matter. Let's go for those 5%. Then the other thing that I was only just becoming better at was, not everyone fits in a team, and that's okay. You know, and so it's actually more than okay to move someone out of an organization and out of a team, and to do that with a lot of care and love and compassion and all sorts of things, but that not being able to step into that conflict and separation holds back everyone involved in that situation. And I've become better at that sense of rejection as well, although only more recently and not practiced enough.
Because you come across as someone, you obviously care about the impact on others. If you think about what you're doing, you're looking at problems that have an impact on society at large and the people in it. And I'd imagine that there's part of that conflict that says, I care about you. You're about to hear things that are not particularly nice.
Yeah.
You're underperforming. You're not doing what you said you were going to do. You're whatever. I don't know what they are, but I can imagine things like that play out all the time. They're people. So, what did you notice you were finding most challenging to be, the word authentic in that, when you looked at those types of conversations?
It was like an imagined reflected experience, I guess, of, if I were that person, I wouldn't want this being done to me, but not having actually thought that through well enough. I think the fear of conflict, that was purely that was the thing at the bottom of
the conflict, yeah.
And that conflict would not resolve well. So I've got better as well at sitting in a space of ambiguity and unresolved tension, having the confidence that that time is a key ingredient of that process as well. And that it can be very uncomfortable, and then there can be a resolution weeks, months, years even later, which is a good resolution.
Yes.
And that I'm not in control of how long that's going to take.
You're not in control of that person either, are you?
No.
Yeah. That's one thing it took me a long time to work out, and it's taken, I'm always working on that, I find. And that point is there is really, really powerful. The you know, these conversations, you know, you can only give someone accuracy on the understanding of the situation, and it's their choice to do something about it. And you want to help them.
Yeah. I think that comes, you've just articulated really what sits behind a lot of what I've done, particularly at Next 25, was this idea that we can be the architects of our future. Yes, there are some things that are going on outside our control, but even within that context, we all have choices at an individual, group, society level, and let's make the best choices we can to go to the future we want, whether as an individual or a group or a society, and build that capability. And so it's interesting how the person I've been reflecting on, how my personal journey is running parallel, has been running parallel to what I've been doing at an organizational level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you think in a subconscious way, maybe you were indirectly solving a problem for yourself by tackling complex problems in the way you do?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
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 And I wonder whether that's what we all do.
Yeah.
And why work is so important. As well.
Yeah, well, it shows up who we are. Mm. You know, I'd say if you speak to an artist and, you start to see these inner dialogues that are playing out about why it's important and what its role is to do and why it matters to them. And I think we all do that.
Yeah.
And it's a good reflective point for anyone listening. I think you don't have to have Ralph's story, but I think one of the benefits of having this conversation is, Ralph, you're being very authentic and very honest about who you are, and I think that's a starting point about understanding how you can take more agency over where you go next, which appears to be what you're doing at the moment. You're deliberately taking time out. So, this decision you've made to, that we talked about offline, but maybe you can unpack this, but you're deliberately not chasing a closure of something quickly. Can you tell us about that?
So I've given myself 12 months to be comfortable with, I don't know what's coming next. And I really, for everyone, it's like the easiest thing to do next is adjacent to what we've just been doing. And I feel like I might have become a bit of a one-trick pony in that world, and I might have done as much as I can do in that world of what I have been doing for the last 10 or 20 years.
Mm.
Maybe not. We'll see. But I have other passions. Like I love architecture. I love hosting. I love design. I love sport. I quite enjoy having a little bit of money. I haven't focused on that for two decades. So there are all these other things. And I want to give myself time and space for something quite different to emerge in terms of what I do next.
Mm.
So just jumping back into the same thing, I think makes it very hard for that new thing to emerge. It's more likely to be adjacent, 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 adjacent. That's mostly exciting, sometimes frustrating. And I find, I don't know if you've found this with other people you've spoken to or for yourself, but I find I'm not physically tired, but I'm probably creatively tired.
Tired, yeah.
In that I get ideas and I get quite excited about them for about a day. And then I just go, oh, this sounds too hard. It's not the thing.
Yes.
So I'm going in and out of some clarity and then walking away. Maybe I'll come back to some of those ideas.
Yeah. Look, only from my experience, both personally, but with a lot of people I've dealt with over the years, I think when you don't have constraints, that actually creates more challenge in terms of decision-making. And I was about to actually ask you, what are some of the parameters of how you'll make that decision? Because I'm sure there are things that show up as more important than others. You know, one of the things for me that over the years has really changed for my decision-making has been the rate of return I get from it.
right,
for the things that matter to me. So I can do I can do something and it might take me 10 years to feel like I've actually achieved, or it might I might hypothesize and theorize it might take me a much shorter time. I want to enjoy my time on this earth, you know. So the rate of return really matters to me. And going back to your point, you know, the reality when these really new ideas come up is that there is this effort phase. And it's like there's always a J curve. It's just how wide the J is.
Yeah.
And so my brain goes, can we shorten the J? How short can that J be? And where am I playing to my strengths? Now, that going back to your point, that might feel very adjacent for some people. So then, the other question I'm often asking is, or asking of other people is, well, if it isn't in the same field, what are the drivers that allow you to shorten that J? Now, that's just me. It doesn't mean it's you, but I wonder for you, what are some of the drivers that help you narrow down how you can lean into something that seems more achievable or enjoyable or suitable for you, I suppose, a better word it might be.
Yeah. So I'm quite a list person and a analytical frameworks person. So, and 2x2 matrices and all this sort of stuff. Right?
Comes with the territory.
Right. So I've spent probably 2 years doing ikigais and my own like vision boards and drawings and 2x2 matrices of, you know, what's in the top right. And it's yielding nothing. So...
you know what the next step is?
So I've given up, right? So I'm interested in the next step, but my current step is I'm just going to wait for it to come to me, and it's going to come.
Mm.
But what's the next step that I should deploy?
Just an opinion.
Yes.
Just an opinion. But I do have a theory that we apply in a lot of our work and to myself, which is a ship in port cannot change direction. It must be active, must be moving.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is to get moving on something that creates a callus. In fact, that's what your whole life's been built on.
Yeah.
So the benefit of that is that the experimentation becomes more real, and it sort of applies some of your own theorems outside of the analysis, because you can only analyze so much.
Yeah.
You only theorize things so much, and then it just ultimately might become a blur, or it doesn't feel real because it's not real. It's just an idea in your head. And we all know how many times those ideas look bloody different too. So I suspect whatever it is, it'll be just a case of having a crack at the thing that might play out as the idea, right? And action will be the cure.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think that I've also been reflecting that I have often been quite impatient. And so the idea of sort of trying to go from 0 to 100 rather than 0 to 10 and just do a prototype, which is just get cracking on the thing. I think what I'm finding with my energy levels is that I'm not even ready to have a crack at something.
Yeah, okay.
I need... And I think it is more like mental, and it's almost like spiritual or something energy. It's not like physical. I've got heaps of physical energy. It's just like the creative element that is, it hasn't been recharged.
It hasn't been recharged. Yeah.
So a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to recharge that battery.
I wonder with the story you shared about the middle person.
Yeah.
How that shows up in the future and what your theory is around how the right person around you might help you create the next phase. And whether it has to be a partner or not, I'm not saying that, but I'm just wondering how you see putting the right people around you in the next journey as important or not.
Yeah. No, it's a very good question. I'm really drawn, have been since I first was introduced to it, to the Belbin analytical framework of like teamwork. And I know there are a bunch of different frameworks around teamwork, but the insight I had from that, which was, I mean, it's embarrassing how obvious this is once you know it, but if you don't know Belbin, there are basically 9 team roles that this organizational psychologist identified through his work. And the and that we love three of them, hate three of them, and are fine with three of them. So that's kind of liberating. It's like, okay, I don't have to like all of them. But then the next bit, which was the embarrassingly obvious one, but was really helpful for me, was like, we're not all the same. And so
and they're all necessary.
And they're all necessary. And so you don't have to be the martyr and do the bits you don't like. And you don't have to be the martyr and give up the bits you do like, because the people don't necessarily want the bits you do like. So I still have a little bit of a default of, I'm being greedy by taking the bits I like. So I want to work through that, which goes to your point then of, well, who are the people to build around an idea who love the bits that I don't love, or who are really good at and love the bits that I am either bad at or don't love?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and still connected to the ultimate vision.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's been fun.
It has. Thank you.
That's all right. I've been really enjoyed. I think it's been a really cool conversation. There's a lot of, I really appreciate your honesty about who you are in the journey you've had. And, you know, you've created such amazing, impactful outcomes all the way from, the story of studying a corporate law to, you know, the next 25 journey. And to me, you know, there was a lot of humility in that. But at the same time, huge impact. A lot that's been created through the journey you've had already, and it'd be exciting to see where you go next. So we might have to do this again. But mate, in wrapping up, maybe just for all of the entrepreneurs, leaders, people out there, any one pearl of wisdom — that's very hard to do this one pearl of wisdom — but anything that you would share to people on a similar journey to you?
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind immediately. One is, be patient and tenacious and bold, and just keep striking the right balance between all of that. I think that's like the overnight success thing. If it happens, happy days. But I think there's just a whole lot of work that goes into, and this gets talked about a lot, but the ups and downs, the almost falling over, starting again, like, but be tenacious and believe in yourself. And the other thing is, I think, to give yourself license to really enjoy the process and enjoy being the person with the idea, and give yourself license to — this is hard, that sort of to get the right balance — but to have the people around you who you both need but who you enjoy, and give yourself permission to get rid of people who aren't helping you and your idea come to life. That doesn't mean getting rid of everyone who's a little bit niggly, because the niggly bit can really help you get to the good solution. But, there we go. There are two.
There's two pearls of wisdom. Yeah, the niggles, they're going to come anyway, right? It's got to be a little bit of agitation, but it's whether there's a general incompetence, big difference there, something that's not working for you. Let it go.
Let it go.
Ralph, you've been amazing, mate. Thank you so much. We'll let you run and get back to it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Anytime.